So what I'll present is a part of a bigger project, and I'll try to say something at the beginning about the bigger project. It's also a paper that will appear in a couple of months, I think, in the Grazer Philosophische Studien.
A couple of things just to frame what I'll say today in terms of the project, that I'll be talking about a notion of presentation that comes from or that is drawing on classical phenomenology, by which I mean primarily Husserl's phenomenology. And so I'll start with that, but I'll try to make it, as we kind of go along, triangulate it with respect to things that might be more familiar for those even who haven't worked a lot with Husserl. The other thing to say is that I will be saying some things about consciousness and about the ontology of consciousness, but I think it's this still fits very much within the ambit of the workshop, because I'll be talking about consciousness and some ontological implications as framed by the sort of essential characteristic, or what for this set of approaches is the essential characteristic of intentionality in the specific sense of presentation. So I'll be talking about consciousness as something that presents, basically, and we'll try to get some clarity about what that phenomenon of presentation is from a phenomenological perspective, and then also relate it to sort of more analytic sorts of metaphysical and ontological concerns. So I'm going to say, first, something about the broader project in which this is a part. So this is the motivation, and also working questions on classical phenomenological treatments. And this is not only Husserl, but I think the whole, really broadly, the whole phenomenological tradition. Consciousness is presentational. It presents, and what I take that to mean, just in a very general sense, for the purposes of this project, is that it presents something as something. And I'm going to insist on kind of the minimal structure of something as something. I'll say more about that in a little bit. And also self-presentational. So in presenting something as something in some way or in some respect, it also appears to present itself. And so there are lots of ways we can think about that structure. I'll talk a little bit about that. I'll be focusing for this paper more on the first of these features, consciousness being presentational. As classical phenomenology has also emphasized, the presentational and self-presentational aspects of consciousness are plausibly intimately related to the ontology and phenomenology of the world as such. So there is a concern in classical phenomenology of the relationship of consciousness and intentionality broadly to the structure of the world, the structure of the world as a whole, the way the world as a whole is given to us, the way it's delimited, and so forth. So this is one of the ways of kind of situating the project more broadly than just in the context of kind of, how do we kind of locate consciousness or intentionality within a causal structure or within the causal structure of the world, but talk about its relationship to the world as a broad phenomenon, as the phenomenon of the totality in some way of possible presentations. So the question for the broad project is, one of the questions is, can the logical and phenomenological structure of conscious intentionality be clarified in terms of those two features in the first point? That is, in terms of the way that consciousness, conscious intentionality presents, the way it's presentational, and the way it's also reflexive, that is, the way that it's self-presentational. And what consequences do those features have for the apparent irreducibility of consciousness and intentionality to a world described from a third-person objective point of view? If they can be seen as generating that irreducibility, those features, then consciousness and conscious intentionality cannot be accounted for, I claim, by means of physical, causal, behavioral, or functional explanations alone. On the other hand, the clarification of its presentational and self-presentational structure also indicates its proper place within or in relation to the world as described completely from a third-person point of view. So this is rather general and abstract, and I want to sort of move closer. So this is the abstract, which is also replicated on the handout for this paper, this particular chapter, which will be part of a broader book. If considered in the context of recent modal and two-dimensional arguments for the falsity or limitations of physicalism, so I'll be looking at toward the end of the paper some recent arguments for the failure of of physicalism that are situated in terms of possible world contexts and particularly modal and two-dimensional semantics. The presentational character of consciousness motivates a novel kind of ontological option for its placement in the world. This option, I'll claim, vindicates the irreducibility of consciousness in one sense of irreducible to description or explanation in terms only of physical facts, or indeed to any facts describable simply from a third-person point of view, and clarifies this irreducibility as resulting ultimately from broadly modal semantic features of the presentation and individuation of entities across possible worlds. At the same time, it does not thereby require or invite anything like a substance or property dualism, since the features of consciousness that make for its irreducibility can also, as I shall argue, be accounted for by means of a global monism of substance and properties. So what do I mean by the presentational character of consciousness? And I'm not, one of the things I'm not going to do is I'm not going to define presentation. I think, you know, starting phenomenologically, we actually, in a certain way, have to start with the phenomena themselves. And so what we're trying to do is not really provide definitions or provide kind of, you know, necessary and sufficient conditions, but work with the phenomena as they are given, as they're presented to us, and try to explicate, try to understand their structure. And so that's a different kind of project. But I will take it that minimally conscious states present or give something or as being in some way. And so what I mean then by presentation, and by in particular the presentational character of consciousness, is almost synonymous, I think, to intentionality or to the intentional content of consciousness. But the sense is supposed to be a little bit more active in the sense that there is supposed to be a sense of something happens, something is done. As Brentano has it, in that sort of classic formulation of the idea of intentional in existence, in presentation, something is presented. In judgment, something is judged, and so forth. So there is an active character to presentational consciousness, as I will be treating it. And so I want to sort of, these are just a quick list, and I'm not going to go into most of these figures at all, of precedents for this notion, I think, or you know, people who are deploying something like this notion of presenting or giving something as something in one way or another. One that I will draw on to some extent is Husserl's idea of noematic sense, or sinne, which is to be understood in terms of the way in which consciousness, typically for Husserl, consciousness presents something, gives something to a subject or to an agent. Sartre thinks about objects similarly as given through certain determinations that he calls, following Husserl, the adumbrations. They're given in some way, in some aspect, or with some kind of characteristic. There is no, for I think all of these figures, simply being given an object full stop, just being given an object just as such. It's always something as something. Heidegger, I'm not going to go into Heidegger, but he has a more general structure that he describes as a hermeneutic as structure, but that is exactly the same structure. They're generalized beyond simply just consciousness, that something is presented as something. And then as the last sort of precedent, I actually put Frege and the idea of a mode of presentation or art discogeben science, a way of being given, a mode of being given. The difference between Frege and all three of these others is just simply that Frege restricts the notion to primarily and essentially propositional context. So he's talking about language and the ways in which sentences and terms give things. These other figures don't restrict it in that way, so that we can talk about the presentational content of conscious states quite broadly without restriction to them being linguistic or linguistically explicable and so forth. So I put, you know, Frege as kind of a precedent in a way, but actually a more limited precedent than the other figures. Okay, so I start with this quote from Husserl, and there's some, you know, verbiage here, but I think that we can get at, you know, kind of what he's suggesting with respect to presentation. And, you know, having had the discussion this morning also about Kant and his notion of intuition is helpful here, because Husserl is drawing on a very closely related notion when he talks about intuition as presentational. So for Husserl, the principle of all principles, this is an overarching phenomenological first starting point. No conceivable theory can make us err with respect to the principle of all principles, namely that every originary presentive intuition is a legitimizing source of cognition, that everything originarily, so to speak, in its personal actuality offered to us in intuition is to be accepted simply as what it is presented as being, but also only within the limits in which it is presented there. So this, as a kind of basic phenomenological maxim, if we kind of, you know, clean up the verbiage a little bit, is saying that what we have to do is we have to start in phenomenological description with what is presented to us just as it is presented. So we have the idea of presentation, and we also have this idea of as structure. Something is presented as something. And this is where we have to start, and in a certain way, where we have to finish with phenomenology. We have to sort of operate within just what is given, just as it is given, in the way that it's presented as being, but also only within those limits, and you know, being careful not to exceed the limits of what's actually given as given. So this is guiding with respect to whatever we will then further say about the semantics or the metaphysics or the ontology of conscious intentionality. Two qualifications about the way that I talk about presentation in here relative to other ways of talking about presentation and representation. So phenomenologically, as far as phenomenology is concerned, I suggest that presentation, in the sense that's relevant, does not need to depend on any kind of internal representation, right? So it may be the case that, in fact, our presentations of the world, our intuitions of objects, our understanding of things are mediated by, for example, internal cognitive representations. But as far as phenomenological description is concerned, we can, to a certain extent, at least bracket that and talk about the pure presentation of the thing as such, and try to describe that structure. So a consequence of that is that it's at least an open view that a presentation may give an object directly and without any mediation of any kind of cognitive, symbolic, et cetera, any kind of representation. So we're thinking about a kind of direct presentation here, at least as a potential structure that we may wish to describe. Also, I would say, sort of just as a caveat, that it's not necessary in order to use the terminology of presentation in this way to hold that all or only conscious states, either that all or only conscious states have a presentational character in this sense. Some conscious states, for example, pure sort of sensory experiences, may not present anything other than themselves. I think they're still in some way self-presentational, that they present themselves to us as having the character that they have, but they don't present any external object. And other kinds of non-conscious intentional entities, for example, spoken written words, sentences, signs, pictures, may also have a presentational character in a suitably broad sense. As I suggested kind of from the precedents, what's in view here in the most broad sense is really kind of a general concept of presentation. I'll be talking for these purposes mostly just about the conscious cases, but it would be nice if we had a kind of concept of presentation or a phenomenology of presentation that held across the board for all kinds of intentional phenomena. And I think we actually could develop that. Okay. So consciousness and possible world semantics. And here I'm going to talk about some sort of more recent and more local developments of possible world semantics, but also a broader history and some ideas in possible world semantics that go back a few more decades to the 60s and 70s. So in the most prominent recent developments, reasoning about possible worlds has been used roughly after Kripke, to establish conclusions about the metaphysics of modality, reference, and propositions. But another important line of analysis, and I'll talk a little bit about this through Hintikka, leading to what is today called two-dimensional semantics, suggests the understanding the content of consciousness in terms of understanding the content of consciousness also in terms of possible worlds. So what I'm suggesting is that there's an older kind of line of analysis that looks at possible worlds as a device, not just for making sense of metaphysical content or of propositional semantic content, but actually of the content of consciousness, or the intentional content of what is presented as presented. And I want to sort of explore that a little bit. And so this is this sort of other line is usually couched as kind of a matter of epistemic possibilities or modalities as distinct from metaphysical ones, so that we can use a possible world analysis to think about what are actually epistemic possibilities rather than metaphysical possibilities, that is, epistemic possibilities for a subject, for an agent, rather than just metaphysical possibilities as such. And I think we can actually broaden that and see that framework as usable to characterize the presentational aspects of consciousness, what I'm talking about sort of broadly as the phenomenon. So I'm going to draw a little bit on two articles by Jaakko Hintikka from the 60s. This is at near the beginning of the kind of contemporary development of what becomes called possible worlds semantics. He's also, in working with them in the way that he is, he's also drawing on strongly phenomenological influences. So he notes the following, that locutions such as knows who someone is, sees what something is, has an opinion as to the identity of someone or something, are apparently de re. They're directed toward a particular object, which is the object of those attitudes. But they may also, and often do, fail to preserve truth value under substitution of co-referring terms. So we can't quantify over these objects unrestrictedly. For example, Smith can know who Jones is, can know trivially that Jones is Jones. Jones can in fact be the spy, but Smith can fail to know that Jones is the spy. This is sort of familiar from discussions of quantifying in and the failures of quantifying in broadly intentional contexts, intentional with an S. So the suggestion is that Hintikka makes is that we can handle these cases, after all, quantificationally. We actually can quantify into intentional contexts if we drop the assumption that the subject's attitude of knowing, seeing, et cetera, whatever the attitude is toward this particular seeming individual, which even in, you know, a substantial issue here is that even in bad cases, the individual may not even exist. So these are the hallucination cases and so forth. So I seem to have an attitude toward this, you know, individual sitting in front of me, yet there is no individual sitting in front of me. Obviously, I can't just straightforwardly substitute in, but how do we do that, right? We require only that these attitudes be directed toward the same quote-unquote individual in each of the worlds or situations compatible with the subject's attitude. So what we're doing is we're making use of the framework of possible worlds here, or possible situations, to talk about my attitude as directed not toward a particular actual individual, but rather across possible worlds to various individuals in those possible worlds, including possibly, maybe, someone in the actual world, but also many others in other possible worlds. And then we're going to characterize the content that's presented by doing that, by characterizing the individuals across possible worlds to which my attitude is directed. So what does the same individual mean here? How do we speak of individuals across different possible situations as being perceptually or presentationally identical? I see that there is somebody in front of me wearing a hat, right? And so I want to pick out across possible worlds all those individuals who, as it were, fit the description. Even when there is actually no description, there is no, in other words, propositional description, there is just a presentation, and I want to explicate the content of that presentation. So Hintikka suggests the following, that we should assume a set, big F, of individuating functions defined over the possible worlds or situations we're considering as possibilities, as epistemic possibilities for the agent. Each of these functions, little f, will pick out for each situation or world, mu, at least one individual from that world's domain of individuals. So these are going to be functions from worlds to one particular individual in each case, picking out one individual from that world's domain of individuals. The functions may be partial at some worlds, including, so this is the kind of hallucinatory case. This is the case where in the actual world, there may be no individual designated. So I can think about the content of my hallucinatory perception, where there in fact is no actual individual sitting there. But I can think about it by thinking about the set of functions from worlds to possible individuals. Across possible worlds that fit, as it were, the presentation. So these individuating functions, Hintikka argues, now can take on the role of the individuals previously imagined as the objects of the relevant propositional attitudes, or indeed, more broadly, presentational attitudes. And this works, you know, quite well, I think, to explain the failure of the substitutivity of identity. Now we can readily explain the failure of substitutivity of identity, even when singular terms rather than descriptions are involved. So this is the example that I already worked through. Smith can know who Jones is by means of identifying information or perceptual acquaintance or any number of other ways, and trivially know that Jones is Jones without knowing that Jones is the spy when in fact he is the spy. This is just because in some of the worlds compatible with what Smith knows, Jones is in fact not the spy. In the actual world he is, but there are possible worlds in which he is not, and some of these possible worlds and their individuating functions, the individuals they pick out, are compatible with what Smith knows. And so more generally, if there are two distinct individuating functions, F1 and F2, relative to A's attitudes involving singular singular terms, such that f1 of lambda equals f2 of lambda, but not f1 of mu equals f2 of mu. In other words, that these distinct functions sometimes pick out the same individual, but in some worlds they don't pick out the same individual. The general rule of substitutivity for all x, all y, x equals y implies qx implies implies qy will fail with respect to A's attitudes q. So if this is all right, then we do help ourselves to these individuating functions. Individuating functions will often cross-identify across possible worlds with respect to metaphysical identities. So take the case where Smith perceives a man before him, so he's in some way acquainted with the person before him, but he doesn't know who he is in terms of any kind of conceptually identifying information or kind of, you know, any further identifying information. So the content of his perception, how do we then characterize the content of his perception? Well, as picking out what are, we might want to say metaphysically, many distinct possible individuals across distinct possible worlds, all of those that are compatible with what he's actually being presented with at the moment, namely, you know, whatever sort of broad characteristics he's perceptually acquainted with. And that will cross-cut different metaphysical individuals, because after all, he doesn't have knowledge with respect, or enough knowledge with respect to that. So there will be lots of different metaphysically identifiable individuals. It's also possible that two of Smith's attitudes cross-identify with respect to each other. So we have different modalities. We have perception, more broadly knowledge. We have, you know, belief. These can cross-cut each other with respect to the functions and the individuations that they involve. So here's Hintike gives a kind of diagnostic story about the, and this is he cites actually Austin as a kind of inspiration for this story about, you know, our tendency to believe in or to accept that there are distinct intentional objects as distinct from actual or possible individuals, and so he's kind of debunking that or demystifying that tendency given the individuating functions. So he says, for some purposes, we can reify. We can talk of the object presented by one of these de re attitudes. But this is also misleading, since, after all, these individuating functions are just functions. And they may cross-cut metaphysical identities so that it's no one metaphysically identical thing that's picked out across all the possible worlds. But, you know, various different individuals. And then if we were to assume that there must be some kind of one, you know, one thing, we would be kind of making a certain kind of mistake. After all, they are just functions. We would just be kind of reifying this function. So, for example, I might be tempted by the following kind of garden path argument, right, that I perceptually identify a piece of chalk as white, right? I see perceptually that this piece of chalk is white. I don't recognize that it's the smallest object on the table S. I don't recognize that S is white, even though C equals S, and I perceptually identify C. So then I may then be tempted, and here's where the misleading temptation sets in, to reify that sensory object, namely the white thing, doesn't have all the properties of the physical thing, namely being the smallest thing on the table. So it's easy, but also misleading, given that, to conclude that there's a distinct object of perception, which is white, but doesn't have the properties of the physical object, namely, for instance, being the smallest and so forth. But we can see, given the analysis in terms of individuating functions, that is kind of a mistake, because after all, what we're dealing with is just the content of a perception that presents many different individuals across possible worlds, some of which are indeed the smallest and some of which are not. But to reify that into kind of a specific intentional object or perceptual object or a sense datum would be kind of a mistake from that perspective. So given that the perceptual or other presentational individuating function is just a function from worlds to objects, there is no need to suppose a distinct kind of entity as the perceptual or intentional object. To the extent that there is any reason to speak of such entities, they are just the reified forms of the relevant individuating functions. But since the ranges of these functions, after all, are just ordinary entities, right? They're just ordinary individuals across possible worlds. There's no need for an ontological distinction among entities between intentional and non-intentional, for example, between physical or material versus non-physical or non-material or immaterial objects. So this is kind of really where you start to see the ontological implications, that we can easily be misled into a kind of separate domain of distinctively intentional objects. But we should not be so misled, because after all we need are just the ordinary objects across possible worlds, if we can help ourselves to the framework of possible worlds. Okay, so now I'm going to, this is sort of the second part, I want to sort of stop, And sort of draw some implications then of Hintikka's analysis, if it is right, with respect to perspectives or points of view. And I think here, I think you can see the phenomenological inspiration, given that, as Hintikka has quite in mind, I think, that classical phenomenology treats consciousness and intentionality as distinctively from a first-person point of view. And so we need to think about, you know, kind of how that's structurally reflected here and what implications the distinctive first-person point of view has also for the broader ontology and semantics of these kinds of attitudes. So Hintikka's analysis allows us to characterize, using the possible worlds framework, types of content, including perceptual and other non-linguistic content, that are distinctively given only from a specific point of view and which may be inaccessible from a completely objective standpoint, abstracting from all specific points of view. These are kind of, partially at least, analogous to indexical characters or indexical modes of presentation, such as what I draw on when I say here it is warm or now it is 3 o'clock. But they're not completely analogous, because I want to say that with respect to what they present and their presentational content, the content available by means of presentational individuation is highly complex and determinate. It's not just a question of a general kind of rule for going from a context to an individual, such as is plausibly involved in the use of a single indexical or demonstrative, such as this or I, but rather highly determinate, highly specific individuations and highly specific kinds of content that are in view here. But that may, like indexical characters, be in some way essentially dependent upon a first-person point of view or a first-person location. So how can we argue for that more fully? Presentationally individuated content will be essentially presented from a first-person point of view if there is no determinate way to present the same content from a third-person point of view. And I think it's plausible that this is actually the case, that there is no way, given these kinds of contents, to present them from a third-person point of view. I'm going to argue for that briefly. Given that Hintikka's individuating functions capture the content presented to a subject, these contents may plausibly be inaccessible from a completely third-person point of view. I'm going to just argue for that a little bit. And so here I want to consider an argument that David Lewis makes. He's drawing on Hintikka's analysis here, and he's raising a question about cross-world individuation, given Hintikka's analysis of possible worlds and presentational content. So he poses the following question. It's a good question, right? But I think that Lewis answers it in the wrong way, and we can see exactly where he goes wrong here, and it's instructive. We can consider then, given all that Hintikka has said, two worlds with various individuals, and in particular this case that he's drawn in this nice diagram. Two otherwise similar objects, Y and X, are objects of acquaintance, for example, perception, whatever, it's kind of the typical modality probably of acquaintance, but it need not be. Anyway, objects of presentation for subjects Z in W1 and U in W2. So we've got otherwise similar objects, cats, X and Y. We've got two individuals in two different worlds, two subjects in two different worlds, who are acquainted with those distinct possible individuals. So the question that Lewis poses are X and Y counterparts by acquaintance? So this is using his specific terminology for cross-world identity, which is the counterpart relationship, but I think that's not essential here. We can just ask, are they the same object, in the sense in which we've been talking about the same, object of acquaintance for Z, that is, for the subject in world one, right? So the question is, does in being acquainted with Y, does Z in world one also present, as part of his individuating function, also X in world two? Right? So the question is, so the answer, obviously, right, depends on the following question: is U the same person, the same subject as Z, right? We want to say, going back to the picture, if U is the same person as Z, sure, they're both perceptually both perceptually acquainted with the same thing, and they are the same person, right? On the other hand, if Z is actually V, then no, right? If Z in world one is the same agent as V in world two, well, after all, V in world two is not perceptually acquainted with the cat, so we can't say that X and Y are counterparts by acquaintance for Z in world one. As Lewis argues, so in other words, what we're going to say about the content of Z's presentation is going to depend upon how we not just how we individuate X or Y, but also how we individuate Z across the possible worlds. And how can we do that, right? How can we identify the subject across possible worlds? This is the question that Lewis poses. And he argues that we cannot identify the subject across possible worlds. He considers various options and rules them all out. And I think he's right about ruling out all these options. For example, we might think to do so by the means of the subject's self-acquaintance. It's reasonably plausible that we are in some way acquainted with ourselves. After all, as we go through life, we have kind of some sense of self-acquaintance or self-presentation. Every subject in a world is plausibly acquainted with herself, right? But we need to do more than that in order to answer this question, because we would need to appeal to self-acquaintance not only within a world, within the actual world, but also across possible worlds. And even if every subject is plausibly acquainted with herself, we can't assume trans-world self-acquaintance without begging exactly the question of the subject's identity across possible worlds. In other words, I would have to assume that is the same subject in order to be sure that I'm acquainted with it by being self-acquainted, and I can't do that. More broadly, we can't do so by means of the subject's self-description, right? So we might look for the subject in the other world that fits most closely my own self-description. After all, as Lewis points out, what we're concerned with here are the epistemic possibilities, the belief worlds, and my self-description might be very badly mistaken. It might be so badly mistaken that I don't even exist in some of my belief worlds, right? For example, some of my belief worlds are worlds in which I believe, worlds in which people, when they're born, are brought by the stork, right? Then I don't exist in those worlds. So I can't identify myself in those worlds. More generally, for any attempt, we can say, I think, to cross-identify the subject by providing any objective information about the subject, we would first have to show that information is really about that subject across possible worlds. And for this, we need to presuppose the cross-identity of subjects that we're trying to establish. This is Lewis's general conclusion, and he concludes that the acquaintance relationship between subjects and objects must then itself be relativized to worlds. We shouldn't really ask whether X and Y are presentationally identified for a subject Z, but only whether an acquaintance relationship in world two is a suitable counterpart of an acquaintance relationship in world one. I would say, though, that this is really no solution given Hintikka's analysis. Why? Because if it's correct, then the acquaintance and relationship in a world doesn't relate me to any other possible world objects. After all, we're just relativizing that relationship to worlds. And perceptual individuation, in Hintikka's sense, doesn't exist. If Hintikka is right, it must be the case that in presenting some object here, that I relate myself and just myself to different possible individuals in different possible worlds. So if individuation by acquaintance does happen, then I can identify which object I'm related to across possible worlds. And to do this, I don't need to identify myself. So I think this is where, Lewis is right, I think, that we can't, in general, cross-identify ourselves. We can't cross-identify the subject from a completely third-person point of view. But after all, we don't need to. I can have the content that I have just as I'm having it, just as presented, without first having to ask the question, well, which subject would I be in all of these different possible worlds. So from this perspective, Lewis's solution, that is the double relativization, is really a denial of the phenomenon. It's just to deny the phenomenon of presentational individuation that Hintikka has explicated. And the reason he has to deny the phenomenon is really just because he adopts a third-person point of view with respect to the possible worlds. He has to, given that perspective, pose the question, which subject is it in each of the possible worlds? And he can't just rely on the presentational content, which is given from a first-person point of view, such that I don't have to first ask the question, which subject would I be in the different possible worlds and objects to which it relates me. Okay, I'm going to go a little bit quickly because I've gone some time over the rest. So this is now then, given that, right, so I've argued for the existence of presentational content in the Hintikka sense, given these individuating functions, and I've also at least sketched an argument for the irreducibility of that kind of content to a third-person point of view, and that it plausibly is given from a first-person point of view, and that it has to be given from a first-person point of view. Now the question for the last part of the paper is, what ontological implications does that have? In other words, what implications does that all have for how we should think about the place of conscious intentionality in broadly the third person describable world. And here I think we can make a kind of cautious appeal to some recent arguments, particularly made by Chalmers, against materialism, and also try to develop those arguments in a certain direction. So Chalmers, as I think will be familiar to some people, distinguishes primary from secondary intentions of concepts according to how they're evaluated at possible worlds. So for what he calls secondary or metaphysical intentions, actual reference to the concept is held fixed, and what is evaluated at each world is this referent. For example, when I think about the identity statement water equals H2O, what I'm doing is I'm holding the actual reference, that is H2O, fixed, and I'm thinking about the identity of H2O across all these possible worlds. By contrast, for primary, or what he calls epistemic intentions, what is held fixed is the initial profile or presentation associated with a concept, and worlds are evaluated as if actual in order to assess which referent the concept would have if that world turned out to be actual. So here's rather the case where I'm thinking about water as roughly however it first shows up or is first presented to me, for instance, as the clear liquidy stuff in the environment, and I'm asking about cases in which that stuff turns out to be something else, XYZ or something like that, rather than just H2O. So Chalmers notes the following, I think all of which is relevant, that primary intentions are more relevant to the explanation of a phenomenon. When we look for the explanation of a phenomenon in general, we're typically looking for an explanation of the primary intention, not the secondary intention. For example, we're looking for an explanation of the clear, watery stuff in our environment rather than an explanation of just H2O. How primary intentions are evaluated across worlds is closely linked to their presentational aspects. That is, what we work with when we work with primary as distinct from secondary intentions is based upon, in a very intimate sense, what is immediately available to us, what's immediately or first initially presented to us. So I designate that, for example, as the clear, watery stuff around here, or the stuff that looks this kind of way. And there's kind of almost an essential, maybe an essential kind of indexicality to that as well, so that I'm looking at the stuff that's around here that's first presented here, and trying to figure out what that stuff is. So it looks like in working with primary intentions, we make essential use of our own presentation of, for example, the stuff around us. Primary intentions are thus plausibly related in part or grounded in part to the presentational character of consciousness itself. And this plays into kind of more specific arguments about the metaphysics of consciousness, especially if we allow the consideration that for consciousness, for conscious states, modes of presentation are plausibly essential to those states being the states that they are. So this is not the case for objects that have their modes of presentation contingently. In this kind of case, the conceivability of cases in which those modes of presentation come apart from each other does not imply a failure of metaphysical identity or supervenience. For example, we can conceive that water fails to be H2O in one sense, but that doesn't establish familiarly that water is not H2O. It just establishes that the primary and the secondary intentions don't turn out to match up. But in the case of phenomenal consciousness, so Chalmers has argued, and I'll just take this for granted, that in phenomenal, with respect to phenomenal consciousness, and I think intentional consciousness as well, it has its mode of presentation necessarily, so the primary and secondary intentions necessarily coincide. So this is kind of just correspondent to the thought that Essie is percipi with respect to consciousness, that it couldn't be the conscious state or the intentional conscious state that it is, unless it presents just what it presents itself just as being that, so that we have to, we can sort of assume a primary, that the primary and secondary intentions necessarily coincide. Okay, so this plays in then to Chalmers' broad argument for the irreducibility of consciousness, against his argument against materialism. He argues that if P is the conjunction of microphysical truths about the universe and Q is an arbitrary fact about consciousness, then first, the conjunction of P and not Q is conceivable, or primarily possible, and this is, though I think it's quite right to steer away from kind of zombie cases, right? There are different ways to argue for this, but one way is to kind of think about the zombie world, in which all of the physical facts are the same, but there is no consciousness. There are other ways into that intuition of conceivability. At any rate, the crucial premise is number two, that if P and not Q is conceivable or primarily possible, possible according to primary intentions, it is also too possible. Or metaphysically possible. That is, and this is something that Chalmers says can't be ruled out, I think he's right, or there is a world that verifies P in which, in other words, things look as if P is the case, but does not satisfy P. And this is the possibility that he describes as a kind of monism, a kind of intrinsic or type F monism, on which physical and more broadly structural facts are held fixed, but their intrinsic, according to Chalmers' view, character differs. And that difference has relevance to the presence or absence of consciousness or of phenomenology. So, and then if P and not Q is too possible, all materialism is false. The conclusion is really a disjunctive one. Materialism is false, or some kind of monist view like this type F monism is true. Okay, I'm going to skip over this, right? So so I want to take all that on board and just, you know, sort of go to Chalmers' conclusion. Either materialism is false, given these considerations, or something like this monist alternative is true, where we have all the structural facts as they are, but we have some kind of variation independently of the structural facts, and that includes physical facts, functional facts, and whatever. I think we can extend this even more broadly to say whatever is describable from a third-person point of view. But we have some kind of variation in those facts that is relevant to the presence or absence of phenomenal or intentional consciousness. And so Chalmers, I think, and so this is my extension or my critique, Chalmers assumes that the only way to do that is to talk about the intrinsic categorical bases for physical or structural properties, that we have to talk about that dimension of variation, which would, on the sort of monist view, account for the presence or absence of phenomenal consciousness as resting in the intrinsic categorical bases for physical, structural, and dispositional facts. I think that's not the only alternative. And I think that if we bring into view more the presentational aspects of consciousness that I've argued for here, and think about the question of presentational content in terms of individuating functions in the way that I've drawn out from Hintikka, we can have a better alternative. So as stated, I would say type F monism, right, the view that Chalmers presents as type F or intrinsic Russellian monism, makes the actual nature and ontology of the intrinsic properties that are supposed to underlie both the structural relationships of physical matter, but also the presence or absence of phenomenal consciousness, makes this mysterious. What should we conclude about the ontological nature of a world in which they vary from how they are in ours? It just is completely puzzling. It's just completely unclear why this kind of mysterious categorical bases of relational facts should be related to consciousness at all, on that kind of intrinsic monist view. What if, on the other hand, we say more, and we alternatively conceive of the variation between our world and a structurally identical but non-conscious world, for example, a zombie world, as turning on the presence or absence of the presentational aspect of consciousness itself that I've tried to explain, right? We might see this presence or absence of the presentational aspects of consciousness as turning on the total presentational individuating functions, as we've worked through with Hintikka, rather than on any properties of the individual entities themselves. So what's interesting, I mean, what's suggestive about this, I think, is that it would be a dimension of variation which would apply to worlds as wholes, rather than just to entities or properties of entities within those worlds, so that some worlds would have presentational characters internal to them, or as structural characteristics, and some would not. Then the existence or non-existence of presentational consciousness in a world would depend on global aspects of that world itself rather than properties of the entities within it. And so what are the implications then if we were to draw out this kind of view? Well, one is that it's not a variety of dualism. As we've seen, it doesn't require we saw this already with Hintikka, doesn't require any kind of duality of different types of objects, physical versus intentional objects, physical objects versus sense data or anything like that. Doesn't require a duality of substances or even properties within the world, but it's consistent with a global monist ontology once we allow in the framework of possible worlds. This position is also not a variety of panpsychism, or it isn't intrinsic monism, as I've talked about. It's the view is not that it's the intrinsic properties of entities or of matter that matters for consciousness, that makes a difference for consciousness, but rather the variation in the total presentational character of a world that accounts for the irreducibility of presentation. And so how might we think about the ontological implication? Well, in some respects, it's closer, I would say, to transcendental idealism. in some respects. That is to say that we're considering the global features of worlds as wholes, and we're considering the relationship of agents presentationally to those worlds as wholes. And so in that respect, it's similar to a transcendental idealist position that locates a subject outside the world and thinks about the relationships of that subject to that total world. But on the other hand, in some respects, it's better, especially if you don't like idealist pictures, because there's no suggestion here that the world is created or produced or synthesized, et cetera, by the activity of a transcendental subject. So we have just subjects that exist in worlds. They're capable of presenting various kinds of phenomena. These phenomena pick out identities across worlds, across possible worlds. No part of that involves that a subject stands outside every possible world, or that any subject, you know, is able to kind of stand outside the totality of possible worlds and, you know, create or produce it. Okay, so I'm going to skip over that. Maybe we can come back to it. These are just some broader ways we might think about the irreducibility to the third person that I talked about with respect to Lewis. So conclusions. If we see the ontological question of the reducibility of consciousness in terms of its presentational character, we can consider its irreducibility as a matter of the irreducibility of the presentational individuating functions which give content from a first-person point of view. After all, on this kind of Hinteregger-style analysis, all there are these functions. And if we can argue that they're irreducible to a third-person point of view, then we're done. We've argued that conscious presentation is irreducible to a third-person point of view. So this accounts for the familiar failure of substitution, as we saw, in intentional or presentational contexts, and metaphysically requires nothing more than the possible worlds framework itself. And of course, some people will balk at that, but I just want to say, like, if you can accept possible world semantics broadly, then you should accept possible worlds being used in this kind of way to characterize the presentational content of consciousness as well as propositional semantic content. However, since the individuating functions and the content they present are themselves plausibly inaccessible, as I've argued, from a third-person point of view, it also explains the irreducibility of consciousness to explanations, for example, physical, functionalist, structuralist, et cetera, given from such a point of view.